Hello, everyone, and welcome to the 12th episode of the Frontend Greatness Podcast. I'm your host, Ari Koponen. Today, we will be talking about how DX is UX. And my guest is Evu Attar. He is a front-end engineer at Facebook and the author of West Validations Framework. Hi, Evu Attar, and welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing good. Could you introduce yourself a little bit and tell our audience what got you interested in developer experience and what sort of thinking you've been driving around the subject?
In the past couple of years, I've been working on a couple of front-end open source libraries, both internally at places I've worked, mostly at Fiverr.com, which I worked before Facebook, and working on developer tools, mostly infras and utilities and validation libraries. And I realized after a lot of work that not everybody likes the code I write, and not everybody likes working with the utilities I write. And it took me a long time to understand why and why what I need to change. And eventually I got to the realization that actually the way people use my code and the way I write it or the way I present it to them actually matters. So it's not just what my code does, but how they use it or how it behaves or what interface it has. And since then, since I've started working on multiple libraries and frameworks, I started working to improve and always iterate over my designs and the way I write my APIs. So this is pretty much the way I got into working on developer experience.
So you have experience working at Facebook and at Fiverr on things that relate to developer experience and your open source projects. I also know that you're quite passionate about, you know, making great APIs and helping developers, you know, be more productive or, you know, just enjoy their work. Why do you feel that developer experience or developer ergonomics really matter?
So I think that the developers, we always try to start by writing code because as a developer, what I love doing is write code. Otherwise, I wouldn't do it. And this is the most exciting part. This is the most enjoyable part because I see whatever I write actually come into life. And this is rarely the most important part of actually writing code. When we write tools or interfaces for other developers to use, because developers have real high standards in terms of what they use and how they use it, and the most opinionated creature on earth is basically the developer, and they immediately sense when something isn't right, and if something isn't good enough, they will just not use it. And the question is, as you asked, what is important to write good interfaces anyway? When people or companies choose to implement a technology, so a tool that we write, for example, let's say we're back in 2008 or 6, I don't know, when we want to implement jQuery. This is an investment we're making. And if this tool is not good enough in terms especially of developer experience, and we'll cover what is good developer experience later, it becomes a liability. The developers have to work to maintain and work with. And it's not easy to use, and it usually causes bugs and costs a lot of money to maintain. So this is usually, at least from the big company perspective, if your tool is not good enough, a company will just not use it. So this is why it is so important to write good code or good APIs.
Yeah. So there are kind of different perspectives. One of them is like the perspective of if you're building a tool that you feel that is solving a problem, if you want other people to use it, then that's a big part of why something succeeds or not. Like during the time, for example, you mentioned jQuery when it was, you know, at the peak of its popularity, or let's say when it was becoming the most popular tool, there were a lot of people who thought that it's not the best tool for the job. Like there were, I think, Dojo and other tools that I've, you know, read blog posts later where the authors explain like how they had almost all the tooling that we have with the modern like stack with React already, you know, 10 years before that was a reality. But it wasn't something that developers would adopt because jQuery made more sense. It was, you know, it was applicable to many more situations. It was just easier to adopt. It solved the problems maybe in a more developer friendly way. So that's one perspective that you know, if you want to actually solve the problem that the developers have, then you need to build something that they actually want to use. And then there is the other, like two other perspectives. I think there's the perspective of the company. So as you said, like the business liability and the decisions around, like, is this something that is not going to cause us bugs and errors, or, you know, is it going to cost a lot to maintain? And then there is like just the simple perspective of me, developer, as a user. I know there are a lot of people who say that, you know, the customer is like the only thing that matters in a sense, like that we as developers shouldn't be so interested in the tools that we have, because we should be very, very focused on the customer. And in principle, I agree. But then in reality, in order for me to be able to work productively, in order to serve the customer in the best possible way, I noticed that the tools that I use, they affect my motivation, they affect my speed at which I can work. And this is not very uncommon. Like, even if you go to people who build houses, they want to have the best drills and they want to have the best equipment, because they know that when you have a shitty drill and it takes you more time to put on the things to the walls or, you know, whatever, it takes you more time and it's not as enjoyable. I've worked with very, very shitty tools. Actually, at the beginning of my career, the first summer internship money that I got, I put it into a sauna lauta, like a sauna raft. So it's like a sauna that floats on top of water. And I had to borrow the equipment and it was crappy. So when I would be drilling, it would last only like 20 minutes. And then you'd have to wait for like an hour for it to, you know, charge. And then some of my friends were working as plumbers, and then they came with their like pro equipment and everything went like 10x. So I think 10x engineer is a joke in a way, but I actually think that sometimes the tools can, you know, speed up your work 10 times more.
Definitely. I mean, I can relate to everything you said, not the part with the sauna raft, but all the others, which sounds amazing, by the way.
It is like, even though I built it myself, I love it. You can go to the middle of the lake and sit. Like, I had a one that is like two stories, like you can go on the roof. Mm-hmm. So you'd first go to sauna and then you could go to the top of the roof and just drink some Coke and enjoy a wonderful summer day and the green and everything. But yeah, sorry, I got excited about
No, saunas. This sounds like my next summer vacation. So
if you ever come to Finland, I'll be sure to take you to a sauna lot.
Most definitely, most definitely. So yeah, I can totally relate to all of that. And the main people who suffer from bad tooling, so yeah, you suffer because people don't use your stuff, but it all ends up on the customer's land, where it takes more time to develop, so your velocity is hurt, your productivity is hurt. And what I've noticed also is that when I create bad tools or bad experience for other developers, they will often cut corners or avoid testing the product in order to not have to deal with the crappy developer tool that I created. And the only person who gets hurt is the end customer or the end user who is actually using the product. And even if those developers don't actually try to slack off or cut corners, it will just happen. And they will just miss important stuff because there is not enough transparency or there is not enough insight on whatever is happening because the framework or utility is too hard to use. So I can completely relate to whatever you're saying. And I think just for terminology, I want to distinguish between three kinds of people. So when working on developer tools or when working on libraries and utilities, we are the developer and other developers are our consumers. And there is the end user who is not related to the library itself, but that's the user that's using whatever the consumer is working on with the tools that we build, the developers.
Yeah. Yeah. That's like from the perspective of a person building the tools, that exactly how it looks like. Then from the perspective of your consumer, they are the developer, and then you are the most likely open source author, whom they either love or complain to, and then there is the end customer. So yeah. But exactly. So that's a good terminology. So when talking about developers in this context, then it's the developer who is making the tool. Yeah, I actually have a good example of cutting corners from real life. In one of the projects that I worked, it was like quite a legacy project. It had like an old Webpack setup for React. So what would then happen is that you'd need to manually refresh the browser when you make changes. And the compilation time would be something like, let's say, 4 seconds. And you would not really know when it's done. So sometimes you'd end up refreshing multiple times. So even making like small changes becomes very, very hard. Or it takes time. And you add to that the time that it takes to refresh the app with all the requests to the backend. So basically, I could say that making one small CSS change, because it was using SCSS, so that had to be compiled, would end up taking at least 30 minutes. So the end result was that the sort of cutting of corners that would start happening is that someone would build a feature, it would be like done, and they would build the bundles. In that setup, you'd actually need to build the bundles manually. And then they'd notice like, oh crap, that specific part of the UI is like, it's okay, but it's not, you know, it may be a few pixels in the wrong direction, the color may be wrong, or something small that really doesn't matter. But with good tools, like if you'd have fast refresh and a good development experience, you'd just do it and, you know, just push it and it would be done. But in that particular like environment, you could see like, I would personally be like, oh crap, like it's the day is ending, I don't have the time to do that, I'll just push this PR. And when you'd look at the code base, you'd see like this sort of small details lacking in every corner, and you could just sense how it has been about, like, because it's just so cumbersome to fix a bug that you notice, so you don't do it, but you focus just on getting the feature shipped. So this is like a very practical example on how just the sheer time that it takes to compile can lead to a very, very, very poor experience, and like the quality suffers, and of course the productivity. I think in that project I spent half of my days looking at spinners and loading, you know, waiting just things to load, and it made no sense. But at the same time, there was this like sense of busyness that, you know, we need to move fast and just build features and focus on that, and the end result was just the opposite of everyone feeling that it's the progress is too slow, but not really being able to kind of understand how big of a deal the bad UI, a DX, or the developer user experience in this case was to the whole thing.
Yeah, the happy days of Webpack 2. I remember those, unfortunately. Yeah, I can completely relate to that. And I think that all those experiences that you had led to, nobody says that, but to the bundler wars, and basically to the abundance of bundlers we have today, especially aimed at making developer experience better. So what you experienced was experienced by hundreds of thousands of developers all across the world, and now you see all the next gen bundlers that we have, and all the first gen bundlers we have, and everything that changed between. So yeah, that's a great example for a developer tool that with a slight change and a slight improvement just changed everything.
I really like that you brought up the fact that, you know, there is this kind of the era of the bundle wars, and I think we're in a way going to the next phase of that, like with tools like Snowpack and ESBuild and this sort of Vite, I don't know.
Vite, yes.
Yeah, Vite. And it's very easy to kind of understand the effects of slow refresh times to how you are productive. But actually, now that I have you on the podcast, I'm actually maybe more curious on getting insights on your experience, like outside of this sort of very, very like clear things that a lot of developers have experienced and know. What defines a good API or a good tool? Like, we know what the issues are, but what defines a good tool?
Yeah, so we've spoken about bad APIs enough, I think, and it's a good idea to speak about the good APIs now. And I think that a good API, there are a lot of metrics and a lot of ways to look at it. But if I try to sum it up to just one sentence, a good API or a good tool or a good library is an API or a tool that helps developers achieve their goals faster in a reliable manner. So yeah, I can ship my feature like twice as fast, but it's not reliable. For example, it breaks half the time. That's not a good tool. But on the other hand, maybe I'm able to create the most stable feature, but it takes me, I don't know, 7 times the time it would take me to write it all manually. That's probably not a good tool as well. So I try to find the balance, and there are a few more nuances to that that we can cover, but a tool that helps developer achieve their goals faster in a reliable manner is a tool that I would say is good.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense. So how you build a tool like that? Like, that's the dream. Yeah. How do you get there?
Yeah, so like there is a long process of doing it, but if I have to like shorten my design process or my development process, development, as I mentioned before, is the least important stuff, because the internal implementation can change and I can make it as bloated as possible internally. But as long as the interface itself is not leaky, and as long as the end user, or sorry, the consumer is not aware of what it's doing internally, then I can change it after I start working on it. So the way I start writing or working on libraries and tools is basically define or even a feature within one of my tools. So for example, when I try to write a new feature for Vest, Vest is my validation framework. I first try to understand what I needed to do or what I wanted to do, what my new feature has to do. And once I have my new functionality scoped, the most important part begins, how I want it to be used. And that's the most interesting and most entertaining part of trying to draft an API. And then I basically take a pen and paper and write down version of how I want my users to use it, my consumers, how I want my consumers to use it and how I want it to behave and what I want it to return, what the interface should be. And then after I've completed multiple iterations of the interface itself, I start working on the implementation itself. And when I say there are nuances to how I want it to be used, there are a few things I weigh when I try to write my design for my API. And the first one is how hard it is to make mistakes using my API. So one thing I believe about good APIs is that they are both safe to use, so they don't have errors and bugs, and both are hard to abuse. So it's hard to make like big mistakes with it unintentionally. And if it's okay to make some mistakes with it, for example, if you do want to inject raw HTML and render it with React, so you can use dangerously setting our HTML, but they tell you it's dangerous. Don't just do it. So this is a really good example for an ugly API, but a good ugly API. It's intentionally ugly. So this is one thing, how hard it is to make mistakes using the API. And the second thing I try to think about is how many things does that API do? And ideally, an API should do just one thing. When it does more than just one thing, it might be a smell, but not necessarily. So when I'm talking about a framework, of course, it shouldn't do just one thing. But when I write a specific interface in it, how many things does that do? If it does more than one, it may need to be split up. But on the other hand, if we're talking about it's doing one thing, it doesn't mean that it has to have only one use case. If it can only do one thing and can only be used for one use case, so if I have something in my kitchen that I can only use for one thing, for one dish, I should probably not buy it in the first place. And we all have that like one dish in the kitchen that we shouldn't have bought to begin with because it's just collecting dust in the drawer.
Like so something like a milk can, or you know, something that is very milk specific. Can.
Yeah, we have like this, not an ice cream maker, but just a tool that you throw frozen fruit inside and it turns it into a mesh. And we've used it once in 2016 and never since. We should probably throw it away.
Yeah, actually, I know one especially dish, the tea bag. holder, like plate.
Yes.
Like it's a plate that exists so that when you make tea, you put the back on top of it so that it doesn't go to the table. So you probably can use also, you know, maybe a mug or something that you might be able to use for something else also,
Or just a saucer, yes. so that's an example for something that does its job, yes, but its job is not very useful. And fourth thing is, will it require learning new patterns? So when I go to learn a new tool, for example, when I try to adopt a new technology, I first think, how long will it take me to learn it? Is it written like something I've used before? Does it adopt an existing pattern? For example, if I try to use something, if I'm very familiar with React and it uses the same syntax, for example, let's say Preact, which basically took the same implementation or the same API implementation and just rewrote it to look exactly like React, which was pretty amazing, I think. And the fifth thing is, is this new API leaky? And by leaky, I mean, does it leak the internals outside? Does the consumer know or have to know how it works internally? And if they do, it's probably not a good sign that the consumer has to concern themselves with how it works internally, because they want something to solve the issue, not to be aware of the issue again. So these are five criteria that I believe are very important to writing good interfaces and good APIs for other developers to use, that are also both, that are also safe to use, easy to use, and usually are intuitive because they do not adopt new pattern or do not invent new patterns, but adopt existing patterns. So they are consistent internally as well. So one good example would be Lodash in its entirety. So when I use one function in Lodash, I probably know how to use most functions in Lodash because they keep like a very consistent signature. They treat collections the same, they treat objects the same, they have the same placement of callbacks. So it's very easy to know how to use Lodash if I've only used a couple of functions within Lodash. So this is an excellent example of a good API in those terms.
Yeah. And I think if there's someone listening who has never built their own utility library, like even a small one, that is actually a very, very hard thing to achieve. Like,
yes,
you so often end up like, oh, garbage, like in these two functions, I have these parameters that are basically the same thing in this wrong order or something like that. So that is actually quite, I think that is probably one of the reasons why Lodash is also so popular. But going back to your principles, I love them. I love them because like the topic today is like DX is UX, and I can see so much parallels to like how you, you know, when you build user experiences, like the first principle of, you know, can I make mistakes? Well, that's something that, you know, you want to make sure when you're building user, you know, interfaces, that you can't do something bad unintentionally. Like every time you have a destructive action, there should be like a confirmation. So this is like in your API, you want to make sure that using it, people don't do stupid stuff unintentionally, the same thing. Then how many things does this API do? Like most often in the UI, you don't want to have places where the user is unsure, like if I push this button, what are all the things that are going to happen? And you most often maybe don't want, like you might want to split like things where multiple things are done to like maybe selection steps, like instead of like, you know, configuring a lot of stuff for the user, you know, at once. And for example, like if you have a tool that is used to configure, like if there you could like load something like directly, you might want them to maybe rather go through it, you know, review everything step by step so they understand what is happening, so there are no surprises. Then the use cases part, like I have a good example from work. We were building like a UI, and we needed to find a pattern for highlighting stuff in the sense like when the user, in this case, they select the number of accounts they're going to buy, and there's a limit. And once they go over the limit, we need to highlight the part of the page that kind of explains that if you need more than 20, you need to contact sales. And we needed to find a pattern that we could use, like that would subtly, like it would take the attention to somewhere, but it wouldn't be like, you know, something that you have to cancel or too visible. So we came up with the concept of highlighting. So it basically just flashes a light color on the background. And that's a good pattern, in my opinion, for our UIs, because we have this same sort of use cases a lot where you want to have a subtle highlighting somewhere. It's easy, it has a good name in our design system, like, okay, use highlighting. We can use the component APIs like to have is highlighted. So this sort of, it has a good language around it. And the same thing when you build developer tools is like, is it something that is kind of easy to use around, like in the tool? I would say that from Vest, maybe, like, just the fact that you have Enforce that you use, like, it's like everywhere. So it's a good starting point. It's a pattern. And then, like, learning new patterns, that's a big thing in normal, like, user interface design. Like, you want to use buttons that are not red for success. You know, you want to that's how you build intuitive UIs. You only change the parts that need to be different for your use case. But the leaky part, I don't know, like, what would be the leaky part in the UX world? But, like, I love it because this sort of, this is a very good illustration, like, the thinking that you're doing is very good illustration on how the same things of human behavior are translated to code APIs or tool APIs in the same way.
Yeah, I tend to agree to everything you said, especially because we think that we developers invent everything and we came up with all these principles, but to be honest, there's nothing new about writing good APIs or writing good interfaces. It's the same science that's existed for like hundreds of years or thousands of years of making good tools, even physical stuff. And when I try to write a new utility, or when I try to write even a new user interface, I try to think of it like a physical object, because I can draw almost all these principles from using physical objects. They have to do one thing, they have to be consistent, they have to be intuitive, they should not be dangerous to use. Hopefully nothing we use is very dangerous. Or if they're dangerous, they do have to have safeguards, very explicit safeguards. So whenever I try to work on a library, I try to think of it like an appliance or something I would use, like a door handle even. A door handle is a beautifully designed API that tells you exactly what it needs to do. And when the door handle is missing, you just have to push the door and you don't know what to do. That's a terrible interface, I would say.
Yeah, from the perspective of a person who lives in a country that has no doorknobs, so we have just handles. A doorknob is a poor API for opening a door, but it's a good example. I think, like, this sort of, like, when it's intuitive, it's easy to work with it intuitively, which to me means that it involves less cognitive load. It's less stressful to work with, which is super important. Like, a lot of the work, like, ways I try to improve my own work is, like, how can I reduce my cognitive load in the environment where I work? How can we make it less stressful, maybe less worrying, maybe less scary to deploy, all sorts of stuff that otherwise ends up being at the back of your brain or something that you really need to focus on getting it done, removing manual steps. One of the past episodes is about automation. So the same sort of thing, but just from a different perspective, like reducing cognitive load of like trying to really understand like what's going on, making things simple. So maybe we could discuss about this in terms of Vest, because I'm very curious, because it's a new breed of validation libraries. So, like, how do you see that, like, Vest employs this sort of thinking that you've described?
So Vest is something I've been working on for the past 4 years or so. First, it had a different name. It was called Passable, and I worked on it when I was working at Fiverr.com. And when I left, I wanted to take a different approach, to take the basic ideas, but improve upon the framework and make some changes and have complete ownership of it and not have to deal with legacy code I created not knowing how to write good APIs. So Vest is like my ultimate playground, because it is starting to get traction in the past couple of months, and I try to employ all my principles there. And the main thing I try to do is the intuitive part, so make it intuitive. And And I'll just say what I try to do and how I try to employ those principles there. How do you make something intuitive to begin with? And I think there are three principles. So every principle has its own principles, of course, or its own guidelines, of course. But when I write a validation framework, as we said before, I write it for JS developers mostly. So the people who need to be familiar using it or have to actually use it are JS developers. And the way to make it more easier for them and more intuitive for them is to respect the platform they're on or they're using. So I know they are using JavaScript, so I need to use JavaScript conventions, for example, use camel case and other stuff. I know they actually, most of them, use Jest or Mocha, and these patterns I actually can work with, so I can build on top of knowledge they already have. So this is something very important for me when working on Vest. I respect whatever platform my consumers are on. Second is I try to follow a pattern. So I try to make all the functions within Vest, or at least all the functions that have a similar behavior or similar structure, to work the same naming, the same structure. So for example, you mentioned enforce before, which is a similar function to expect. So I'll just try to explain how Vest works in general. Vest is a validation framework that's written similarly to a unit testing framework. And internally, it actually is written the same as a unit testing framework. So I actually played with the idea of writing the unit test for Vest with Vest, but ended up not doing it because then the universe would collapse, probably. Yeah. Probably, yes. I cannot guarantee that, but probably. And when you write your validations, you write your validations the same way you would write a unit test. So yeah, so like you have a test in a unit testing framework, and internally you have an expect. So the terminology for expect is not very good for a validation framework, but enforce is better because we're enforcing the data itself. So I try to write enforce its value and is something. So I try to keep consistent the naming. Is string, is array, is equal, and on and off. And what I've seen in many places that I've tried not to emulate is places that actually try, or not try, but just use different naming or inconsistent naming for their utilities. So if we take a Node, for example, the file system module, the FS module, we have all the read file and write file and copy file and watch file functions that are all written in camel case. So if I asked you to, for example, tell me how would you imagine the read dir function, how would you spell it?
I would spell it with read and capital D and IR. Mm-hmm.
So apparently many functions in Node use the camel case, so read file, write file, watch file, but read dir, make dir, and make file all use the POSIX naming. So it's read and dir with lowercase letter, and make dir is mk dir and mk file. So you cannot guess what the name of a function would be just by remembering it. You have to look at the documentation each and every time, and that's something I tried to avoid for people who use Vest. I try to follow a pattern so it's easier for them to follow along.
I think that's a really good example, the Node.js one, because I think the person who wrote the read dir things was trying to serve a specific developer audience who, you know, would be coming from Unix. So they would kind of expect it to be written. But then at the same time, parts of the API were written with different principles. So like this is a good example on how, like, even if you're trying to cater to a group within the product, within the tool, you should kind of still be consistent with your choices. So you can't kind of change the principles that you're employing or the conventions that you have, even if it in some cases might make sense from a specific perspective. Yeah. All right.
Exactly. And the hard thing about it is that when you write something and release it to the world, people start using it and then you are unable to remove it and it's stuck there forever. Like, I don't think anyone will ever be able to replace that. They may be able to just add new functions or aliases to those functions. And that's something I work hard on when working on Vest. And I try not to introduce new interfaces until I am certain they are needed, until I'm certain that they actually provide a good solution to the problem, because otherwise it would be buggy, people would not want to use it, and I will not be able to remove it because there would be people who actually rely on those bugs. So one very important thing is, do not add stuff you may regret on adding tomorrow. So it's way easier to add later than remove.
Especially when you have a lot of users. I think React 18 is a very good example on like a lot of the DX principles that we've been talking about here. I'm one of the developers who was like thinking that, you know, the concurrent mode and suspense will never come and we will all, you know, grow up, have gray hair and die. And it was like frustrating because those things were kind of things that might affect my work, but I'm not sure how. But in the way that, you know, Dan and the team explained everything on Twitter just maybe last week, like, it was very enlightening. Like, they knew that they wanted to have an API that you can't make mistakes with, that will not lead into bugs. And right away when they noticed that the APIs that they were building did have this sort of flakiness or they were bug prone, they went back to the drawing board, and now they have like a solid foundation. So that is totally true. And the more users you have, the more important it is. And also, I think React 18 is also a good example of people being a bit skeptic about the fact that React is starting to have a lot of this. The scheduling part of React is quite hairy, or it's quite complex. But it doesn't matter if the external API is super good. So it doesn't matter if the tool does things for you that you don't understand, as far as long as it does it consistently. And then, like, going back to Vest, like, just this, the last question before we go to the really last question, but this is like about DX, and Vest is a good case study from my perspective. A lot of developers, in terms of like form validation and validation in general, are used to schema-based validation. So you have a schema where you kind of, you would almost like type the data that you have. Like, how you feel that Vest kind of, in terms of developer experience, like, what's the benefit of the API that you have in Vest compared to schema-based validation?
Yeah. So first, I just have to say there are some amazing schema validations libraries out there, and I'm not going to say anything bad about any of them because I think they're really amazing. And I think your question could be a bit broader even, because as I see, the way I see it, especially in the front-end world, there are three kinds of validation libraries, and then there's Vest. So, and no, it's not that unique, but, and there is nothing revolutionary, but I think it takes a slightly different approach than the others. So there is the rule-based or the matcher-based validation frameworks or libraries, they're not even frameworks, that basically take a value and give you a set of functions. So for example, is email, is number, is whatever it is that you're looking for. So you get the function and it gives you back a Boolean. So these are very good at what they do. And actually I use validator.js many times because I do not trust myself to write a good is email regex. So, and yep. I don't think anybody should.
Yeah, everybody just that's go. That's the thing that no one should do themselves.
Yeah. Everybody just go use validator.js to get their is email function because it's the best, and it's better than writing a 60 line regular expression to catch all the quirks of an email. So there are those. But they don't give you structure, and they don't help you write your code or structure your code or at least operate with your code. They do not know what's changed, what's dirty, what's already been validated. They only give you a Boolean for whatever value they pass. And then there is the schema validation libraries that are very good at what they do. And there is Yup and Joy and there is Zod and many new others. And they're good at what they do, but they care about the shape of your data. So I would love to place them, for example, in my API, on my server API. So when I get my requests, I get all the data, and this is amazing. But it's very hard for them to do stuff like, for example, upon user interaction, only validate this field. What you would usually have to do is filter out all of the fields that haven't been validated yet. Or, for example, run unit tests, or sorry, not unit tests, A/B tests on the data or on your validation. So I have a feature that's only available for some of my users, so I want only some of my validations to be applied for them. So you have to do many gymnastics to make that work for them. And so you don't have the benefit of knowing whatever's changed or whatever's dirty or whatever's validated, but you do get a lot of flexibility in terms of structure, which is good. And the last thing is not a specifically a way of validation, but a different breed of validation libraries and frameworks, which are UI first validation libraries and frameworks that have either components that you put in, so form components, inputs and form and checkboxes and whatever, that provide you with the ability to know what's changed or what's validated or the current status, and they keep the state of your validation. And the second thing they do, or the second kind of UI first validation libraries, are validation libraries that give you handlers or functions or event handlers that you put on your elements, and then they operate everything behind the scene with your UI. And these are very good because they do have a lot of structure, but you do lose a lot of control over your UI and the way you do stuff. And I think that Vest tries to introduce a completely different approach to this. I try to give you all the benefits of a UI first framework or a library in terms of I keep the state of what's been validated. I allow you to only validate whatever's changed and upon user interaction, but I also allow you to keep some structure of your form and of your feature. So Vest doesn't care about your data per se. It doesn't care about the shape of your data the way a schema validation framework would, but it cares about your feature specifically, and it looks at it holistically. It tries to validate it the way the user would use it and the way you as a developer or as a developer would want it to be used. So this is the main difference, and of course it's hard to explain how different it is, but I try to separate my validation from my feature. So if you use Vest, it's framework agnostic, for example, so you don't even have to rely on it being working with React or whatever. You could switch your framework completely from React to Angular to Vue and not change even a single line of validation, because the validation is completely separate. It has its own internal state that's separate from React state, and basically it tries to speed up your development and make it easier to work with.
It sounds to me like Vest could be the perfect couple for Final Form JS. Erik Rasmussen, who is the author, was in this show like a few episodes ago, and we discussed form validation then, and like he doesn't have any default options, but like it's in that sense a good match that it's also framework agnostic. So that would be an interesting pair to see together.
I actually listened to that episode. It was very good, and I think one thing that he described that actually made me think, oh, Vest does have some things in relationship with Final Form, is he described it as like an engine that's not related to, like a headless engine that has no relation to any framework or whatever, and it has bridges to other frameworks. But the difference, the main difference that I see, is that Vest needs no bridges. It just works with whatever framework you have, and it doesn't care about the way you interact with your form elements, but it only cares about the data going in and the data going out. Yeah. So this is the difference.
All right, thank you. The last question for today, and this is no longer about DX is UX, so no longer about developer experience, unless you want to recommend something like that. So the question is, what resources, books, blog posts, people to follow, YouTube channel, whatever, would you recommend to a front-end developer who wants to go from good to great?
Okay, sure. So One thing I have to mention is in terms of API design, many of my principles, as I mentioned before, I draw from physical objects, stuff that we actually use every day. And this is like nothing new and nothing, I think it's from the 80s, but there is the book, The Design of Everyday Things by Donald Norman. And in this book, he describes all the principles for designing actually safe, usable tools, from door handles to toasters to cars and everything. And as a developer, you'd see, oh, there's nothing new in what I do. It's actually a timeless art. So this is a book I must recommend to anyone who wants to take seriously his or her API design. And the second thing, I cannot recommend more. There is this guy, Christoph Nakazawa. He used to work at Facebook until recently. I think he just left a couple of months ago. And before that, he worked on Mutuals and stuff. And within Facebook, he worked on the Jest team and the Yarn team and the React Native team. And he has a new blog. And in this blog, he takes you through the journey of API development and developer experience. And in the recent, very exciting episode, there is both a podcast and a blog and a video on YouTube. So in the latest episode, he just walks you through building a unit testing framework similar to Jest, which is very exciting. And I really, really enjoy these. I really enjoy his content. So you should check it out.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I can recommend Christopher's blog also. I think I tweeted like maybe just 2 days ago that, you know, no snake oil here. I really like the fact that he's really, like, there are a lot of people who produce content just for the sake of producing content and getting attention. But like from his content, you can see that it's more about really giving good advice that based on the experience that he has had at Facebook and the tools that he's been building. And actually the first part of like the first episode there is actually about how to build great APIs. So that's a good addition to this podcast to continue to. All right. Thank you, Evyatar, for joining me. And thanks to everyone who listened to this episode. And we'll see you again or hear you again in a few weeks.